Every successful person got there by going through tough times. Success is a hard-ass teacher who likes to knock you around along that journey. You know, it takes real guts to not give up and keep going. We'll hear stories about failures and how these leaders flipped the script to create success. I'm John Schultz. Join me and let's discover how success is never really overnight. Welcome to the John Schultz Podcast, the myth of overnight success, a topic I love and love finding people that have lived this life and have been grinding it out. And we have an amazing guest today, Maeve Wang, the founder of Iambic. Look at that. She's got, if you're on YouTube, you'll see the beautiful neon sign behind her. She's co-founder and CEO of the company. And this is a really cool company. It's a software company turned into a custom fit shoe company that uses AI, like all the cool things that we want to learn about today. She was recognized as Time's Best Invention of 2023. I love that. It's a great publication. And what I think is the coolest thing is she's the recipient of the U.S. National Science Foundation's grant. Now, that's got to be the most difficult thing you could probably get as a startup, especially, right? Because it's all risk, and we're going to learn about that today. And, you know, one of the quotes I've heard her say, which I think everyone should put on their refrigerator, is good enough is not what we're going for. And to me, if you live your life like that, you're always going to get a little bit better in your own way and in your own time. So welcome, Maeve. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
All right. So, you know, this show goes all the way back, right? Because I think a lot of the skills and habits and just inspiration is when we were young, we picked that up along the way. So I'd like to start out with you. Can you tell me a little bit about your childhood and how that sort of spurred you to today?
Yeah, I was born and raised in L.A., if you've ever heard of the term Valley Girl, that's my valley, for better or worse.
Wow.
And I'm the child of refugees. So both of my parents came here after the fall of Saigon and were looking to build a better life. And I was just really grateful that they really took that leap to come out to the U.S. And start from scratch. So that was definitely part of my DNA growing up.
Wow. So what lessons did you learn from that? I mean, when we're young, we pick things up. Like, what do you think that gave you in confidence or in anything that you sort of pursued?
When they came, they really believed in the American dream. That's very real to them. And growing up, they really instilled so many of their hopes and dreams in me. My mother actually passed away when I was a bit younger. So it was really my father, my single father, who raised me along with my younger brother. And it was this wonderful combination of there's this American dream and you can, you know, be successful, build yourself from the ground up and also, you know, do what you're excited about and hopefully make something meaningful of that. And I really carried that with me growing up, like being able to do something meaningful, being able to build something from scratch, being able to do something that I could also enjoy personally.
You didn't take things for granted, right? Like, which is, I think, the most important lesson. You know, every day is the day. And, you know, we never know what's coming next. So as long as you don't take it for granted and you're open, you know, good things can happen. You got to work hard. So it sounds like your family was a role model. Did you have any other role models growing up that inspired you?
Yes. My ceramics teacher in high school, I consider him and his wife my Jewish parents. And they really took me under their wing during high school. And I had a bit of a rebellious phase. I would pretty much just go in after cross country and make pots after school every day, every summer during high school. And they really also built up my confidence in being a creative too. So I initially didn't want to go to college. I wanted to go to art school. I'm glad I didn't because I'm not very good. But it was, I think they made me feel like I could do something special too. And that was really meaningful for me.
So. And what do you think the insights and lessons you learned from them that like stuck with you? Because obviously, I know mine. Like I had like what I felt was a second father. Like, because there was things I couldn't talk to my parents about because I wanted to feel like I was achieving something. Even when I was in high school, did you get any lessons from them that carry with you?
The quote from my ceramics teacher was, "Then what?" He was this architect turned divorce attorney turned football coach turned ceramics teacher. And that progression really helped him understand how to infuse meaning into your work, how important that would be. You achieve all of these things, but then what? And so he'd always say that to me, when you're ambitious, but also confused in high school, and someone, a mentor comes to you and he's really confident in you, even though you're not confident in yourself. And he goes, "You're going to do great things, Maeve, but then what?" So make sure the things that you do that are great are also meaningful. So that really kind of built off this childhood that my father, this foundation my father cultivated. So I felt really fortunate to have all of them in my life.
That's a great bumper sticker, "Then what?" Right? Because it's so true. It's like, and what I hope people realize as they listen to all these stories, and I'm like up to 70 now, is that "then what" means like you better enjoy the journey, because once you get there, right, without the challenge, it's never as fun and you never feel as purposeful or rewarded. Is that something that you feel through your journey or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's amazing. All right. So you said you did go to college. Where did you end up? And, what were some of the things you did in college as far as major? What was your focus?
I was fortunate to attend Harvard College, and a lot of it was because of scholarship, financial aid, and they were really ramping up those sources of support when I was applying, so I felt really good about that. And when I went to Harvard, I discovered that there was this whole world of resources that I could tap that I didn't know had been available to me before. And I really went to experience as many new things as possible and travel the world. So my goal actually going to Harvard was, how many places can I travel? How many new experiences can I have for free? So I pretty much just applied to fellowship after program after program, and was able to go to everywhere from Tokyo to Dubai to Istanbul to Uganda, and do really cool things, work on amazing projects, meet really amazing people, and get to know myself. Now, in class, I ended up majoring in government with a minor in economics. And I don't always talk about that because I don't really enjoy talking about politics. And I don't think that that really contributed significantly content-wise to what I ended up doing later. But that's what happened. And then once I graduated, I was like, that's enough schooling for me. So check
good
that
for
box.
You. What were some of the challenges? I mean, because Harvard is a very competitive place, right? Obviously, tons of entrepreneurs spur out of that school. What were some of the challenges you felt being in such a competitive environment? And how did you keep confident? Because, I'm sure you had mentors there too, but that sort of sets the stage for how you are when you leave.
So when I applied to Harvard and some of the other Ivies, it was actually on a whim. It was not something I initially aspired to in high school, because, as I mentioned, I initially wanted to go to art school, and I really loved writing as well. And so I put a lot into my college essay. And Harvard and some of these other places, they were like, just submit an essay about yourself. And I was like, great, copy and paste, here we go. And I had a few other really fun side things in high school, like playing the drums, in a band, and a few other things. And I think they just kind of piqued their interest. So I felt kind of lucky getting into some of these schools. So when I got in, I thought I was going to be demolished. I was petrified. I was like, these are some of the most brilliant people, most ambitious people around the globe. You know, how am I going to survive here? And then when I showed up, I was like, oh, it's not that I was disappointed, but I was like, oh, a lot of these people are just like me, and I'm actually doing fine. I'm actually doing all right. I might be doing kind of well here. So it actually really built up my confidence because I was so nervous and scared going in. I guess it's baseline expectations and where you go from there.
Well, I think that's what we do to ourselves. Like, our thoughts are not always real, right? So like it's a shame because we have so many negative thoughts. It's almost, you know, I saw this study. I think we have 60,000 negative thoughts a day. We can't control. They don't even know where they come from. They can't even figure that out at this point. So it's so important to know that, you know, your thoughts are not real. And a lot of times thoughts are what stop us from taking that leap. And I love the lesson that you found out it wasn't what you thought. So if you just take that out of how you think every day in anything that you do, you may have a chance to do something you wouldn't. And obviously, that's what you did with your career. So you went into Harvard. When you got out, what was your
60,000 negative thoughts a day? Really?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. I feel a lot better about myself right now.
And the other thing they're finding is they're mostly from the day before. In other words, if you don't change your thought pattern, and that's why they say to wake up and say three things that are grateful for that day. So you can sort of start getting your brain to look for what's grateful in your life, not all these thoughts that are coming in and consuming you. It's like a tactic. Wow. It's like a tool. So I try to do that every day. I'm constantly searching for what was grateful that I had happened to me the last day. And it could be like, I had an amazing podcast with Maeve. You know, I got to meet someone that I, you know, never would have met through this journey of podcasting. It could be that I opened up the door from someone at Dunkin' Donuts and they smiled and I felt like I did a good deed. Like, you got to just constantly be searching because, like, especially as an entrepreneur, besides what is naturally coming negative, we're also creating our own negative thoughts by what we're doing every hour of the day. So I think it's an important trait. Besides breathing exercises that, you know, I think also help, but
100%.
So thank anyway, that. So that's some good tidbits for entrepreneurs. Hopefully if they listen, they'll try some of those. But you left college, obviously, you know, Harvard always gives a lot of opportunity to its students when they're looking for work. So where did you enter the workforce and what, how did you end up choosing where you were going to go?
I could not have started my career in a better place. I started off as a consultant at Bain.
Okay.
Initially at the time, I sometimes joke that management consulting is a harbor for indecision. You don't want to say yes to anything yet, so you don't have to say no to anything yet. And so you get to go in and as someone just starting off in your career, having the privilege of working with industry leaders, Fortune 500 companies on their most compelling challenges, initiatives, goals, negotiations. It was incredible. Also terrifying, baptism by fire, because you're going in and the expectations of you as a representative of your company are tremendous. And so I really loved it. But I also learned a few things about myself that made me realize that consulting would not be for me long term. So that was also very important to me.
And what did you learn?
I learned that I really wanted to have ownership and skin in the game. As a consultant, you're not allowed to disclose the nature of your work or who your clients are. And I often really loved the nature of my projects, especially some of them. And I wanted to tell people about it, but I couldn't say a word. I couldn't even put my name on any of the presentations or materials that I created. And it kind of broke me a little bit. I was also someone who, rather than sitting around waiting for an email response from the client, you know, I would make an extra trip over and just swing by their office and ask for 5 minutes, knowing they'd end up giving me 50, and just knock things out that way and walk over to my team really satisfied saying, hey, I just cut down a few things by a few days. And one thing I recall the team of my last project mentioning to me was, Maeve, I think you'd make a really great entrepreneur. And I genuinely had no idea what they were talking about at the time. No idea. I was like, what do you mean by that? I was like, oh my God, are you telling me that I should quit consulting because I'm doing such a terrible job? Or there were so many better consultants than me, but I really didn't know what they were talking about until years and years later when I reflected back on that. I was like, so many people around me saw me on this journey long before I did for myself. And so I was fortunate to have people around me kind of appreciate things that made me special.
I love that. It's a lesson, right? Because it's like what you believe you can will happen. And, you know, you got some hints along the way. And I also believe it happens when we're ready. Like you just weren't ready to take that in and do what you needed to do as an entrepreneur, but here you are today. And I know, I guess after that, was that when you went into Delos, which is this amazing startup that's yes. doing really well today still? Was that your job after Bain, or how'd you get into yes. that?
I was, one of my favorite cases at Bain was actually in retail and technologies. And it really, at the time, we were looking at ways to enhance the physical retail experience through different technologies. At the time, like Bluetooth beacons were a thing. This is like 2013, 2014. So I'm going to caveat that. Yeah. But it really helped me think more deeply about how people engage with the world around them and the physical spaces that they're in all the time. So it kind of piqued my interest in real estate technology. And the human experience in that sense. And when I came across Delos, I met the COO, Pete Schala, and he really saw something in me and really took a chance on me and brought me onto their ventures team. At the time, it was corporate development.
Yeah.
They were kind of driving some explorations into digital health, data analytics, digital content. And I was like, I would love to be part of this. And so they kind of created this role for me there. That was where I really kind of learned a lot more about my, at the time, intrapreneurial chops, so to speak, you know, and I started kind of orienting more of the initiatives on the ventures team from corporate development to homegrown product development. Because I was like, there's so much IP that we could generate, that we could also own, that where we bring even more value to our partners when we go to market, when we build things together. And that was what helped me start realizing, oh, I really like building things from scratch.
I'm listening to you. I love this because there's the consultant just, you know, feeling that you had no ownership, no ability to talk about what your belief was in a product, no ability to enjoy and share your happiness about it. Here you go. You're in a startup, which is now you can talk about it, but that's not even good enough, right? Like you're now diving in on how to make your own within. And, you know, I feel with companies, especially entrepreneurs, it's so important to have people that like are not afraid to talk, you know, tell their ideas, right? Because you get in a tunnel vision when you're working on something, as we all know, and having smart people around you bantering, you know, new things, and that might be a pivot and might be why. Because I find startups are never what they were when they started. It's just the end product is never the product that we all start when we have a new company. So I love that. So you were involved in creating new products, right, at Delos, and then obviously you had a successful career there. What was some of the challenges you felt that made you stronger? Because obviously we know you started Iambic, and we're going to talk about that, but that's a huge step to go out on your own. And what do you think, was it a challenge that created that for you? Or was it just it was always in your DNA and it was going to happen?
at Delos, I actually met another mentor, and his name was Tyson. And he was a strategic advisor to a CEO at Delos. I believe they'd met through Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh, and really? Oh, wow.
Tyson, yeah, he really took me under his wing, and he saw something in me. And he saw how much I was putting into some of these product development efforts at Delos. And he talked about the potential for them to maybe stand on their own. And, you know, it was very blue skies at the time. But what I realized in some of those conversations was that it wasn't just enough to have ownership in the employee sense of the word. I really wanted to have real skin in the game. I was like, if this is a success, I really want to benefit from that success. And if it's an absolute failure, I'm okay taking that on too. But I really want that now, because I discovered that I'm somewhat of an obsessive. I would go into the office at Delos on weekends, Saturdays, Sundays, and people would joke on Monday morning that it was like beautiful mind. They'd come in and all the glass walls would be covered in my like dry erase marker.
That's such a good movie. That's such a good movie. I love that movie.
Yeah, and people are like, "Oh, so Maeve was here this weekend. Oh no, what's she up to now?"
You were drawing, like literally drawing,
like the most elaborate, you know, diagrams too, so that on Monday I could really clearly share with the team, this is where I really see this going. Here's how I could explain it. God. And I was like, "Oh, I'm doing a lot of this, and you know, I love it." And I actually saw myself with the company really long term until I realized, you know what? I want to take even more ownership of this now so that I can benefit from it. Because I had more confidence in myself at that point. And Tyson really played a role.
So, Tyson, obviously, you know, and I know like every big move I made, like it was never by myself. Like there was always someone there that gave me the feeling that it would be okay. Even though I thought I could do it. It's amazing how we need those little pushes and pulls. And obviously Tyson did that for you. So, okay. So you ended that at Delos, and now let's talk Iambic, because this is a crazy, unbelievable idea. I had on the Untuck It founder who changed an entire industry by making a shirt 2 inches short and just had all the supply chain issues that we're going to talk about with you. So you step out and you're like, how'd you pick shoes? Like, how did you come to this is the product, right? You're in digital health. I mean, you would think, okay, let me find another little healthy product that I can do. So how did this happen?
So I was just someone who really struggled to find shoes that fit. I don't have particularly odd feet, but I have a very tough combination of very common traits. Slightly wider forefeet paired with slightly narrower heels. So I lovingly consider them duck feet. And because it just makes finding shoes really hard. They're either too narrow and they pinch, or they just slip on and off like flip-flops. And my breaking point was when I hit, I feel terrible, 300 returns in 3 years. And I didn't even know it gotten that bad until I realized that some of the refunds hadn't been issued because I was trying out so many new shoe brands that were just getting their fulfillment return systems up and running. In retrospect, I just want to thank Nordstrom and their amazing customer service. And I feel really sorry. Please don't blacklist me. I now understand the financial environmental implications of what I did, but I didn't at the time. So once I dug into it, I had the biggest guilt trip about it. But
no, they went in doing that. No, they all knew that you can't have e-commerce without returns, right? So they all knew what they were getting into, even though it was probably worse than they thought.
It's a 40% return rate for shoes purchased online. Yep. It's insane.
I just returned one last week. Like, I totally get it. Like, right? and it was a new brand. Like I can order my old brands and they're still not perfect and they're all different. Even when I get a new pair of the same thing, it's not the same.
Oh, we'll get there. Oh yeah. So at the time I was like, there are over 20 billion pairs of shoes manufactured around the globe every year. There has to be a pair for me. And I tried every fit prediction tool, every foot scanning kind of contraption out there at the time. I had my partner drive me up to Connecticut, to, you know, upstate New York, to deep Jersey, to try to go to the most sophisticated shoe stores with the most sophisticated foot scanners, gait analysis systems. And I tried every little size suggestion tool online, some of the early foot scanning apps, and they yielded nothing. What I ended up getting was amazing profiles on my foot shape. And then I would not get accurate size suggestions. And then in person, they'd say, "Hey, Maeve, it looks like you might be a 6.5 extra wide, but we only have 6.5 and a 7 in stock. How about you just size up?" And I was like, wait a second. So I came all the way out here, drove an hour. My partner, I mean, drove me an hour because I refused to drive. Some people should just stay off the road. I'm one of them. And I was like, you're still just sizing me up, and this is still an approximate suggestion. This sounds terrible. And so at the time, because I came at it, I was working in data analytics, digital health, computational biology algorithms. I was like, maybe this is just a data matching issue. And my hypothesis was, if we could get high resolution fit data through a consumer grade device like your smartphone, so that I didn't have to go to all these places that were really far, and if I get really high resolution product data by working directly with the brands and the retailers, then maybe we could utilize a combination of 3D modeling, but also material science to match the two. And then in that case, it could be a B2B software where we could help people find shoes that fit for them while reducing returns and exchanges for all of these brands and retailers. I met my co-founder and CTO, Raza, who has over 10 years of experience in 3D modeling, computational biomechanics, AI machine learning, orthopedics. And he was like, this is a big problem. I really understand the physiological impact of some, you know, poor shoe fit, and I want to do something meaningful about it that can touch people's daily lives. And I was like, nice to meet you. Let's do something. And then we brought on board the number one foot and footwear researcher in the world, Hilton Menz, who's based in Melbourne, Australia, because a lot of the Australian foot research is actually more advanced than that of in North America, for a handful of different reasons. Then we brought on board our app developer, who also had a PhD in material science, our UX UI researcher designer, who was a sneakerhead, our designer who cut her teeth at Condé Nast, our data scientist, who was a former physical therapist. We got this team together. We applied for a National Science Foundation grant, Small Business Innovation Research, the SBIR program, under the digital health program, because that was where I really started. And we applied in the most competitive year on record. Didn't know that at the time. It was 2020. And so, you know, all people were doing were just staying at home, writing grants. I'm glad I didn't know that. There was like a 12-month delay on top of a 6 to 9 month review period. So when we submitted it December 2020, I didn't expect to hear back until 2022. I was like, you know what? We did our best. What it did was it helped me recruit a world-class team, and I'm grateful for that experience, but I really hope we get it. We ended up hearing back within 2 months, secured it within 4. And at that time, we were starting to test our foot scanner with brands across sneakers, dress shoes, hiking shoes, and it wasn't working. And there are a few reasons why. I mean, can you guess why, John?
I can't guess why, actually. Tell me.
Two reasons. First, error propagation. The second, error exacerbation. First, what we discovered was that the way that shoes are designed and made today, they're really only optimized to fit about 33% of people really well. For about 40% of people, they fit tolerably well, or they just don't care. They prioritize fashion over comfort, and more power to them. Some of us can't do that. But for 27%, I consider us the silent major minority. Yes, we're the minority, but 1 in 4 is still significant. And these are the people who are excluded from standard sizing and frustrated by the problem. And so the people who are most likely to use the foot scanner didn't have shoes that were designed to fit them anyways. On top of that, there was error exacerbation, quality control issues. We had to go in there and test the millimeter level accuracy and precision because we're government funded. We have to report those stats to the government, right? National Science Foundation. And when we went out there to these brands, they were really excited to test our technology with us to the point where I was a bit surprised. I was like, listen, I know what we're building is really exciting, can provide a lot of value, but why are you this excited to test this with us? And they came back and they were like, no other fit prediction tool out there has ever offered to test the millimeter level accuracy of their tool. And I was like, well, no wonder that none of your tools work. And then we went in there and we're like, wait a second, our fit predictions are off by a lot. We're talking 3, in some cases, 20 plus millimeters. For context, a half size is 4 millimeters.
Wow.
And we were like, we double checked our foot scans and we're like, it's not the foot data. Even if we're using ground truth, something's still off here. And we found that the shoes, the physical shoes that we received did not match the specs that we were working with in our algorithms. So the product data was either inaccurate or it didn't exist. It didn't matter how accurate our foot scans were. And the shoe models that had the highest return and exchange rates had the largest discrepancies. I'll let you draw your own conclusions from that.
Yeah, no, it's a mess. It's sort of like, I guess I'm going back to that comment I made at the beginning that good enough is not what we're going for. And like, you just did not waver. But like, okay, I get it. And like, starting any new company, these are the issues. Like, but what was the timing and the challenges? I mean, you had this team. How do you, have to, you know, make money. What were some of the things that, like, with all this technical stuff sort of going not perfect, that you had to deal with?
So we dial into this, right? Like every step of the supply chain, because we have to figure out why, like, what is driving these discrepancies. And in one case, it took up to 6 months, and we were being put in touch with materials providers in Korea, factories in Vietnam, last makers, the shoe mold makers, you know, in Central America. And no one would take accountability for these discrepancies. And to the point where we realized that people were starting to ask us for quality control programs to go in there, because if you have a fit prediction tool, it requires millimeter level accuracy, precision, and consistency throughout the entire supply chain. And the fast fashion supply chains that exist today are too fragmented and archaic. If we were to go in there and remain a data analytics software solution, we would have to go in there and establish quality control measures first, which in some cases,
manufacturers of all these other shoe wear, right?
It could take us minimum 2 years, maximum 5 to 10 in some cases, right? Depending on how elaborate the supply chains already were. And our team was really stressed. And we're like, oh, wow. Did we go into the supply chain quality control program, you know, solution? I'm not sure. We have 10 years, sure, but do we want to spend 10 years going in and really rolling up our sleeves and digging into all of these existing broken systems? If we really want to get people shoes that are their best fit, we might have to do it ourselves, build it from the ground up, and start at that most individual level before returning to mass production. And so we looked at it and we're like, you know what, there's mass production and custom fit. It's existed for eons, but it has remained inaccessible. And we were like, why? And you can only really get them for dress shoes or boots.
And it's expensive. Without something.
And yes. They're expensive. They can cost between $3,000 to $10,000, take up to 12 months to make. because they're fully hand built. And the reason, the biggest bottleneck is in the shoe last. So this is the shoe mold that shoes are built and designed around. They define a shoe's fit, feel, function. And for centuries, they've remained this fully handcrafted art because they must preserve an elegant silhouette while fitting your foot. That's not just a science, that's also an art.
Yep.
So to give you like kind of a quick demonstration here, if you took foot measurements and you converted them into a shoe mold using science alone, you get an orthopedic shoe. So orthopedic shoes aren't hard to design, but the issue is desirability. Many of the people who go through the process of getting an orthopedic shoe still don't want to wear them. Even if you were to round out the toe box of an orthopedic shoe, you still get a clown shoe or a paddle. Look at that. Now compare the nuances of this with the nuances of this. It's the most delicate sweeps, angles that make the biggest difference in getting you a shoe that fits your foot while remaining elegant. That's why it's resisted automation and digitization for so long. And so we had to go back to the National Science Foundation and we were like, okay, thank you very much, program director.
Yeah, because you have this grant, you got to sort of like, follow what the grant's for. Pretty much.
And yeah, and we're like, okay, you know, this fit prediction tool is not working. And our program director was like, I'm not surprised. And I was like, what? What do you mean by that? And it just so happened, and this was not in his profile, that he had worked for a footwear supplier for Under Armour in his previous life. This was a fun fact. It just so happened. Funny.
That's
right?
Too much.
And he also had people in his life who could only wear orthopedic shoes. And so he really understood the problem from a professional and personal perspective.
Oh my God. That's almost weird. Like how does that happen?
It was wild. And we're like, no wonder we heard back from you so soon compared to a lot of these. It explained a lot of things. Let's just put it that way. And we were so grateful. And he was like, you have the right team in place. I believe that this is the right team to solve this problem. Come back to me with a new plan, with a new solution, but you have to make sure that this is something that is absolutely necessary, that it's not a niche product, and that no one has developed this before because it is a government R&D grant. You have to prove that this is a technology that no one's ever built before and is absolutely necessary and can have major social impact. And we're like, okay, here we go.
Could you pick a harder test? I mean, you got to scale something that no one's been able to scale, like individually. It's like almost impossible.
So I have a lot of founders who've approached me over the years since, and they were like, how did you get a government grant for a shoe brand? If you can get it for a shoe brand, I can get it for like a t-shirt or something. And I'm like, not the same. Let me explain to you. In order for your work to deserve taxpayer dollars, right, it has to bring value to a large number of people, but
absolutely,
it also has to be technically challenging. So you have to explain, you have to demonstrate that no one else, you have to prove that no one else has developed this before, right, in industry or academia. You have to explain why. And then you have to explain how you're going to do it when no one else has. Can you, are those thresholds you can meet? And then most founders are like, oh, hey, maybe not. Maybe I consider something else. And I was like, yeah, it's not the easiest path.
But how many years so far has this all been going on?
2 years. So at the time when we are looking at this and we were like, we might have to create our own shoe brand and we might have to create custom fit shoes to get that high resolution data at the individual level that involves fit data, foot scans, comfort preferences, and feedback. It was end of 2021, early 2022, and then we decide to go all in, and our program director gives us the green light. Then we bring on board an industrial design legend, Coleman Horn. He has been in the industry at this point for 30 years, has worked for every major brand you can think of, you know, Nike, Rothy's, right? Saucony, Ralph Lauren, Timberland. And he helps us set up our supply chain and design our first shoe. And it's, we're over the moon about it. We find incredible partners based in Portugal. And Portugal has this beautiful blend of this centuries-long heritage of shoemaking, and along with this openness to collaboration and innovation. And we found this really wonderful factory that doesn't just have contract manufacturing operations, but also has their own bespoke shoemaking practice, which they've had for over 80, 90 years, where they've had clients from around the globe. And when we visited, I saw walls of shoe lasts that they had for clients where they demonstrate, hey, you know, this client came from Germany. We've known him for 20 years. We've added layers of leather over the years because he's gained a little bit of weight, you know, and your feet spread with age. And it's really about adapting to it. And I was like, oh, wow, there's so much more to this beyond just getting you a shoe that fits just right up front. And it really inspired how we actually think about our shoes on a deeper level. So
nuts. What I'm learning from you through all the different things that you've done, like how people should understand, everything equates back to where we are, right? Yeah. Where you said, I'm going to Harvard, I'm going to travel everywhere. It's making you not afraid to go and do all these things and find people. You know, I'm in real estate. I'm in like three states, right? Like when I go out of those states, I feel like, you know, shouldn't be there. So I love, you know, and I think it's important, and that's being open to learning from your younger life. All right. Yeah. So you have this now shoe AI in theory, right? I know it's helping you with some of the project, and it's not a software company now, it's a shoe company, right? Which candidly, it's like the beverage company. It's gotta be, it's like the most impossible vertical to break in, literally. What are some of the things you learn and challenges now that you have a shoe and it's working? And you know, I don't know how many of you sold, and where are you seeing your next challenge to scale this?
There were a few steps to get from last to shoe.
Okay.
Because the shoe last is actually shoe agnostic, right? You can build dress shoes, boots. You can build a lot of different types of shoes on a shoe last. So we had to pick and decide our shoe design. And so this is one of our models here. This is our Model T. And we picked we call this a dress sneaker. It's like a premium sneaker. Because what we found was that 80 to 85% of Americans turn to sneakers as their daily go-to shoe. Pre-COVID, that was 60%.
Yeah.
And our goal was to get people shoes that could become daily wardrobe staples, shoes that they could wear after the workouts on the way to the rest of their lives, to their meetings, to their conferences, to their brunches, to their nice dinners, right? That three-day trip to Boston where you want to, you know, go to that meeting, go to that nice dinner, meet your friends at a bar, walk around the park, and you don't want to bring 3 to 4 pairs of shoes. We want this to be that go-to. But the issue is that sneakers are actually the most challenging shoe to custom fit. The reason why you can only get them for dress shoes or boots today is because those shoe constructions are fully hand-built. What makes a sneaker is this big rubber chunk here. So what we had to do was actually go in and create a 3-layer sole. So this sole is actually 3 different elements that each have different material properties that have to be fused together. To find a sole maker that was A, willing to do this, and B, could, was really intense, but we ended up finding one. And so what you see here is actually a really flexible sidewall so that it could adhere to different lasts, a really durable outer tread so that it could be really durable while being flexible on the sides. And we want to reinforce it with this additional layer so that it could last a long time. This is a premium shoe, but we want people to wear it day in, day out without worrying about it falling apart. And what we ended up doing was actually embedding a few features into the shoe based on what we learned about how we wanted to treat our customers. We actually call them clients because we want them to feel like VIPs. And so do you see these ridges here and this layer of color? So these ridges function like wear bars on a tire. Have you ever noticed how your shoes wear out differently on your right or left side?
Yeah, we have
inner outer
days.
Heel.
Yeah.
So that's actually a physical record of your walking patterns, your alignment, your balance, your gait. But all of that data is lost every time you chuck your shoes. The shoemakers never receive them. The last makers never receive them. And no one's ever been able to systematize the analysis of that. You can bring your shoes into a podiatrist's office and they can be like, oh, you know, it looks like you overpronate or oversupinate. Maybe here's a solution. Here's a shoe for you. Or maybe here's an insole. What we've done was this is actually a stylized grid and we call it your sole print, almost like your fingerprint. And as these ridges wear down, they're going to wear down in different ways based on your walking patterns and reveal a layer of color in the outer rim. And so that is going to give us an opportunity so that before your next pair of iambics, you have the option of providing comfort feedback on your previous pair, along with taking pictures of your sole print from different angles. And we have a different AI model where we can process those images to analyze your walking patterns and fine tune your next pair, either the last itself or the cushioning so that it could feel better, last longer. It's the shoe that can evolve with you. It's not just a one and done.
No, it's like custom. It's amazing. And to scale this with, you know, you needed to have the tech sort of background and team to be able to actually scale something, because, you know, shoes are like a core part of our like everyday life.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. All right. So you're now in what phase? How many shoes have you sold? How's this all faring through all this? It sounds like you've always picked the hardest thing you have to do to be successful. So everyone's going to want to hear now, how's this working? Is it working successfully?
Yeah. So last year, you know, after 3+ years of dedicated government funded R&D, we finally launched and it was incredible. We had a launch event in New York City, which is where we're headquartered. 30 minutes before our launch event ended, our first feature was published. It was a 1,500-word article about our journey, software to footwear, and it was beautiful. 2 weeks later, our Forbes feature was published, much sooner than we anticipated. And so we opened up pre-sales that day. And within 2 weeks, our first limited edition sold out with zero marketing. It was our high-end white glove service. It was $1,100. So we were kind of taking a Tesla rollout approach to this, starting off with limited edition, higher end, cultivating deep relationships with our early adopters, making sure that they are seen, heard, we incorporate their feedback, enhance the experience, and also incorporate those learnings and build our scale gradually. Then we released our Model T later on in the year. And we then got word that we were a Time Best Invention of 2023. And the part about that actually means the most to us is that we didn't even apply for it. So Time has two processes, one where you can, you know, pay $500 or thereabouts to submit an application, be considered. Another where they source nominations from their global network of correspondents. And with that, we were nominated without even knowing that we'd been nominated until after the fact. When Time reached out to us, it was through the comment box of our website. I initially thought it was spam because I was like, this is cute.
Oh, there's like, so many fake things on the internet.
Right, exactly.
You don't want to click on anything to even find out whether it's fake or not. Right.
I was like, you know, there's probably some really janky PayPal link we're going to ask for my financial information. Yeah. And I was like, wait a second. There are a lot of @time.com email addresses on this. This looks like I should look into it a little bit harder. And it was real. It was real. And so the team was just over the moon. We've really built our brand around individuality, breaking the mold, embracing your own unique needs, authenticity, and to have this type of authentic recognition, that meant everything to us. So that was the part that actually we were celebrating, not quite just the accolade itself. And after that, it's really just been culting deeper and deeper relationships with the people who find us. And for us, it's all about organic. We're not going out there and, you know, pursuing major full funnel marketing campaigns at this point. It's really about finding the people who resonate with us, just naturally, the people who kind of might be like me, just out there walking around in discomfort and just done with it. But people who don't want to wear orthopedic shoes, because you don't always need that, right? Fit goes beyond just orthopedic needs.
If you can scale this manufacturing wise, you know, I'm thinking like, you know, every orthopedic foot doctor, you know, this is a product for every single one of their customers eventually, right? It doesn't even have to go mainstream like Nike, like in stores. This could just be a focused product for people that actually care. And I just see there's unlimited possibilities
actually,
in this.
Like, we made a decision, and this was actually based on the advice of our NSF program director. And he was like, do not go into orthopedic shoes. And we were like, okay, tell us more. And he actually thought about it through the lens of both the niche element, the branding element, as well as the regulatory component. And for us, fit goes beyond just orthopedic needs, right? Like, I'm not in there. I've never had foot surgery. I've never had, you know, arch issues. And we're dealing with the foundational aspects of footwear fit that are 3D issues.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we built our brand on individuality, breaking the mold. It's not just, we never really talk about fit in our language as a problem, because that's not quite what this is about. It's about giving people an option that they didn't have before. It's about people who believe that they deserve more and are willing to invest in themselves.
Do you think AI, really, because we're talking AI all the time, will AI really help advance scaling this?
Yes.
Like, because you're in this, right? Like, we're reading, you know, you don't know what to understand with AI. There's so many places it's being, you know, thrown at us.
We've been working on our AI model since before AI gained this level of hype. I mean, in the early days, when we talked about, you know, AI-driven personalization as we're beginning our pivot, people told us not to mention AI. They were like, don't talk about AI. No one's going to care about the technology. Just focus on the value proposition. We're like, oh, okay. Then, you know, a year ago, people were like, why aren't you leading with that? And I was like, The world's changing real fast, and let's get on this. And for us, AI is not gratuitous, because for us, it's about adapting the shoe last in a way that's automating it, removing the most labor-intensive bottleneck to make what was this former luxury accessible, to an accessible choice for more and more people. So for us, that's what our AI is about. It's about kind of removing this bottleneck that's been there for centuries, that has been really hard to overcome, by blending art with science. And one of the reasons why we kept our name Iambic was because we always saw shoe fit as more than just a science, more than just data analytics. And iamb is a metrical foot. It's how you measure rhythm in poetry. And our goal has always been to get people shoes that align with their unique rhythms by marrying that art with the technology. And when we realized that there could be so much more power in this, because iambic begins with the two most powerful words in the English language, I am, we were like, we now have to turn our logo from all lowercase to all uppercase, because we're going bigger and bolder now. And so it's been an incredible journey to get to this point. And we're just really grateful for everyone who's been part of it, and the people who've been excited about our story. People like yourself, you know, who found us and just, you know, supported us.
Well, it's a great story because, like, you have so much longer to go. You know, you're not looking to be a unicorn tomorrow. Like, the way you're doing it, and first of all, you're taking the hardest challenges that most people just would not be able to go to, you know, wake up in the morning and get up and go to work because it's so hard what you're doing. But you're not in a rush. You just want it to be right. And like, that's back to why companies were successful ever. And yeah, it takes time and energy, and you're doing it. And I want to congratulate you.
Thank you.
And you know, everyone that's going to watch this is going to just love this. And I just love the detailed nature you have. Like, you know, every little aspect of it, yet you built the best team. Like, you knew you could not do it yourself.
Yeah.
And you were not afraid to go anywhere to find that team. And like,
yeah,
so everything you've done has been hard, yet you get through it each time. So congratulations to you.
And so just to kind of recap where we are today, for our orders are open for our Model T, which are $550. And it's through our fully virtual consultation, which is that smartphone foot scanner. That's now the foundation of this experience, where you take three pictures of each foot from three different angles, top, inner, and outer views. You complete that survey about what comfort means to you, and then you receive our shoe. So
I love it. And it's iambic.com? Is that the
iambic.co?
.co. Yeah. Okay. That's where they can find you.
.co,
and obviously,
yeah,
you know, people should check this out. It's amazing. I'm going to check it out myself. So thank you so much for being here. And, you know, now I know why you have the glowing logo, because your energy, your belief, it's going to glow out to the world, and you're going to do so well. So thank you.
Oh, thank you, John. This was really fun.
Hi, John Schultz here. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. Would really appreciate it if you would like, comment, subscribe, and share with your friends. Looking forward to being with you soon.